In this episode of Cube FM, I got a chance to speak to Angel Barrera, who is a senior platform engineer at Adidas, and we spoke about Adidas' journey in transforming its container platform management through a strategic shift to a GitOps-based setup that was initiated in May 2022. Now, this move marked a crucial evolution in handling Adidas' extensive global infrastructure, which spans multiple continents and supports thousands of developers. Before GitOps, managing configurations across dozens of clusters was time-consuming, and it was also complex, which often led to deployment delays. The new approach aims to streamline operations, enhance resilience, and improve visibility into configuration statuses both globally and locally. Check out this episode as we dive into how this transition has reshaped Adidas' technological landscape, driving efficiency, and maintaining its leadership in the fashion industry. Stay tuned as we unpack the details and challenges of this monumental shift and prepare for the next phase of innovation at Adidas. This episode of Cube FM is sponsored by our friends at Control Plane. CNCF Flux serves as the backbone of modern cloud-native GitOps-powered application continuous delivery. Through its declarative approach, automation, state reconciliation, and seamless Kubernetes integration, Flux is adopted by thousands of organizations worldwide. However, regulated industries have additional security and compliance needs when operating open-source software at scale. This led Control Plane to hire Flux core maintainers and built Enterprise for Flux, an enterprise-grade distribution equipped with minimal, distroless images, build assurance, streamlined vulnerability management for all Flux instances, and 24/7, 365 enterprise support. Control Plane and Enterprise for Flux ensures the longevity and sustainability of CNCF Flux while providing tangible value to regulated industries worldwide. All right, Angel, thank you so much for joining us today. Could you tell me about three Kubernetes tools that are catching your attention?
Sure. So for example, the one that I'm looking more closely these days is Virtual Cluster, for example. And this is a technology that, I was curious, always curious about multi-tenancy models in Kubernetes. And I think that we all know about namespaces in Kubernetes now, as a way of segregate the Kubernetes cluster somehow. But with Virtual Cluster, you can create control planes on top of a control plane. And this is really interesting for some use cases, like, for example, A-B testing different Kubernetes versions, or provide that for different users or for different tenants the possibility to create a newer Kubernetes release in order to test their applications, or in the other way around also. It's interesting if they have a super old version of whatever company that they need a specific Kubernetes release, you can spin up this virtual cluster just for this use case and then unlock the main cluster upgrade process, let's say. So Virtual Cluster is something that I'm keeping an eye on. I think it's really, really interesting. What else? The second one could be Crossplane. Crossplane is something really interesting also in the infrastructure area department or whatever, because it tries to fill the gap between the platform users and the platform owners, where the platform users could request some infrastructure components or databases or networking attachments or whatever to the platform owners in a declarative way. And then the platform owners can create these kind of modules that can plug and play here and there and can be used, reusable and so on and so forth. So Crossplane is something that I already tested 2 years ago. It was a super raw experience at that time with some problems with etcd with all the CRDs. But I have a really good friend of mine working at Abound, the company behind Crossplane, let's say, or supporting Crossplane. And I know that it evolves a lot in the meantime. And probably the third one, I would say, Service Mesh, whatever Service Mesh, maybe sitting Service Mesh, because it can plug some eBPF programs in order to interact with these packages. And for some use cases, it could be really, really interesting. And for some use cases, one of them could be observability and tracing and this kind of stuff that could run at the kernel level instead of in the container or application level. So for me, these three technologies are really interesting these days.
Very good. Now, can you just tell us a little bit about your background, what you do, who you are, and where you work?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Ángel Barrera. I live in Madrid, in Spain. I'm currently working at Adidas. It's a super big retailer, knowing by everyone in the world. And my role there, I'm senior platform engineer, whatever, level two. I don't know how to explain it, but in the end, my role there is as an enabler for different developers. We have around 1,000 developers working across the globe, so you can imagine how difficult it is to manage this container platform at Adidas. It's super challenging. So yeah, senior platform engineer working there, enabling different teams.
If I may ask, when did your job title become platform engineer, and what were you before that?
At Adidas, I just joined as a platform engineer. Eventually, I got the senior keyword as a prefix. But before joining Adidas, I was working at a startup, and there I was like, I don't know how to say it, but the man that do everything in the startup. So, it's senior platform engineering at Adidas.
And how did you get into cloud native?
That was nice. It was, I don't remember to be honest when the time was. I guess it was 2016, 17, or even earlier. I was working for one of the largest banks in Spain. At that point in time, I was a Java architect or a Java expert working in the backend architecture for the bank. And at that time, we were transitioning from a SOAP web endpoints to JSON, REST, RESTful technologies. And at the same time, we were dockerizing this architecture to make it compatible with this container orchestrators. And there is where I found Kubernetes and OpenShift and these technologies, along with the cloud. AWS was my first cloud, let's say. And also I was in charge, so I was part of the decision at the bank, for the platform of the bank, to decide what technology to use, if it was OpenShift or Kubernetes or Deist or Mesosphere at that time. And yeah, it was really nice discovering the cloud, all the capabilities of the cloud and the container orchestrator. For sure, I knew Docker before, because in the end, as a developer, we were used to use Docker every single day. But for container orchestrator, cloud, and cloud natives, it was that time when I was a Java architect, Java expert, working in a super large bank here in Spain.
A long time ago, there was K8 Spin.
Yeah.
Did it help you jumpstart your cloud native career?
Yeah. I said we because it was a project or a SaaS that we built with a friend of mine, Paul Rosselló, who is working in Giant Swarm, a super nice company providing managed services, managed Kubernetes clusters. And we met a lot of people at that time. I remember these days with a lot of love, a lot of patience, because we built something that was super interesting. It was super challenging because it was like a namespace as a service, as a SaaS, meaning that we had to build a hard multi-tenancy model on Kubernetes when there was none about that before. And we met people from Google, from AWS also, IBM. I knew Daniel from Lem Kubernetes. A lot of people. And people from Docker too. It was really, really, really interesting. And the different companies was interested also in our model. They were right, unfortunately. The model of sharing a namespace in a dedicated cluster was not the right one because of multiple reasons. And the winner was to create this multi-tenancy model based on different clusters. But it was nice to fight against giants at that time.
And, you know, Kubernetes ecosystem moves very quickly. How do you keep up to date with all the changes that are going on? What resources work best for you? Are they blogs, YouTube videos? How do you stay on top of things?
Yeah, that's a good question. The CNCF and all everything around the Kubernetes ecosystem, it's evolving super fast and changing a lot. And to keep track of everything, what I used to do is to follow, for sure, some key accounts on Twitter or X, the platform, whatever. And so, for example, then Kubernetes, some CDOs from different companies like Darren Sefar from X Rancher, and Henny Jacobs, Alando, different key accounts on Twitter. It's nice to follow. And also from Sysdig, they used to write this, what's new in Kubernetes, one dot whatever. They write a nice blog post around what's new on Kubernetes with the security content of the releases. Because if you read the Kubernetes release notes, yeah, it contains all the information, but probably is too much for regular users, let's say. And if you want to go to the important bits, Sysdig is writing a nice recap of the what's new on what's been released on Kubernetes. And yeah, so Twitter mostly, sometimes LinkedIn, but LinkedIn is more for job seeking, and blog posts like Sysdig, another blog post from for example Uber or yeah Lyft, and these kind of startups also write, also has a nice blog, technology blog, so it's pretty nice to read them. Absolutely.
If you could go back in time and share one career tip with your younger self, what would it be?
So I'd say that push as much as you can while you are young. I mean, young in your 20s or 30s, you should push as much as you can and push your and pursue your goals as much as you can, because whenever you grow, both in the family and also in your job, you will get more responsibilities, meaning that you cannot do all that you were doing before. So pushing as much as you can when you're young, because yeah, then your brain is not anymore on your 20s or 30s. And yeah, it's something probably only related to me, because I feel exhausted after 11 years working on this. But yeah, in the end, it's really rewarding. At the end of the day, when you just see the performance improving on your company or in a product that you're building, it's really rewarding. But it's also challenging to keep up to date, to keep on this level when you grow up.
All right. So for the main topic of today, as part of our monthly content discovery, we found this article that you wrote titled, mm-hmm. How We Are Managing a Container Platform. So yeah. The next questions, we'll be taking a closer look at this. This is the first time we'll be mentioning a specific date on the podcast, but something happened on May 10th, 2022. It's a very specific date, but one that you're very clearly attached to. What happened?
It's specific, that's true, but this is like the first commit that we perform on the GitOps repository when we decide to go all in on the GitOps approach. Because for sure before all in with this approach, we were testing it out. We were testing different approaches, different project structures, so different things before saying, okay, this is what we want, and let's start doing that in a proper way, right? In a professional way. And that was the day, the 10th of May, 2022. That's really specific, but this is like the first commit saying, okay, this is the bare minimum project structure, and we commit more changes eventually on this repo until today. Absolutely.
Let's take a step back then and explore the status quo before you started the migration. Could you describe the infrastructure and practices before investing in GitOps?
Yeah, so this is, 2018, two people were in charge of creating the container platform for Adidas. And fortunately, these two people had the the right ideas in mind, right? The right mindset. What was their right mindset? They thought about having everything as code in different repositories, but at that point in time, there was not Flux, there was not GitOps, there was not multi-cluster configuration at that time, so that they have to develop something to solve this issue or challenge of managing different clusters for a large company, right, with all the constraints that we have. So they start on-prem with 5 to 10 clusters, so it was not that much number of clusters, all on-prem, as I mentioned, and they create this kind of structure configuration structure, having one Git repository per cluster and one centralized Git repository hosting common configuration for all the clusters. And eventually, different branches for different purposes, like the configuration for different components, like the ingress was in a branch, or in the shared configuration repository, we had the different environments, development, production, so on and so forth. And eventually, Jenkins runs pipelines that merge the configuration and then finally applies the configuration to the actual clusters. And that was working fine. I mean, kudos to the team, because in 2018, there was nothing better, to be honest. And kudos to the team, because it was working until 2022. And that was kind of the project structure configuration of how we were managing clusters at that time. So two people doing their best with the right mindset, developing this kind of mechanism, merging configuration here and there, and applying the configuration to the cluster. This is more or less what was done at that time.
And, you know, in terms of the deployment strategy before the migration, was it all GitOps based?
No. As I mentioned, it was a push model, being Jenkins the one responsible of merging the configuration and applying the configuration in the clusters. So it was not GitOps based. But as I mentioned, as the team at that time had the right mindset, it was easy enough to get all this configuration as it was in code, and then create this project structure for GitOps. So at the end of the day, everything was as code, but the deployment process is now radically different.
I imagine the process grew organically to this point rather than being architected from the very beginning. So I imagine it served well to explore GitOps until it became unbearable. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So eventually, as I mentioned, we started, or the team started with on-prem with 5 to 10 clusters, I don't remember, to be honest. But then AWS came to the scene on Adidas, and we had the possibility, or we have the possibility, to spread these huge clusters into smaller ones across the globe. So instead of having just clusters installed in Germany in the headquarters of Adidas, now we have clusters all over the world, from America, Europe, China, you know, all over the world. And instead of having 5 to 10 clusters, super big clusters, now we have, I don't know the numbers, but less than 100 clusters spread across the globe. And, you know, the configuration was working fine with this lower number of clusters, but when you have to have this amount of clusters, this become unmanageable at all. So yeah, then we discovered that we had to switch, and eventually I joined the company in 2021. So yeah. And I realized that we were struggling a little bit with the cluster configuration. So yeah, I took the responsibility on exploring this alternative.
So what happened next? Did you gather around a whiteboard to sketch the deployment process would look like? What were your plans?
Yeah, so I sat down with one folk that was in the beginning of the journey, of the content repositoryization journey. And with her, we set like the requirements or the constraints that we have to have in place on this GitOps approach. Because, for example, it's in the blog post, but you know that Adidas is a global company, and you have to take care of a lot of regional specific things, and this has to be easily overridable, meaning that for sure, in this case, I just remember one use case, which is China, for example. The New Year's in China is completely different to the rest of the world, so you could expect China to have more restrictions or different freezing periods or something like that on certain times, while the rest of the world doesn't have this freezing, and the other way around. So we have to be flexible enough with the GitOps approach, as we were with the legacy cluster management process, to have this overwritable configuration in place in GitOps. So we sat down together, we set the requirements, the required features that we have to have in GitOps, as we have in the legacy cluster management process. And we draw a plan, and we also set some KPIs here and there to measure the success of the migration. And so what we wanted to avoid, for example, with the legacy approach, is to open 40 or 50 PRs whenever you had to change everything on every single cluster. So with the legacy approach, as you remember, as I explained before, we had a repository per cluster, so meaning that if you had to change something for every single cluster, probably you would need to open 50 PRs with a pull request review to people. It's a massive amount of time. But not only the time of reviewing, also the time consumed to open these PRs. And also, we wanted to avoid human failures while creating PRs, because we are humans and we fail, and we could miss a comma here and there or a dot or whatever, and we can mess it up, and we wanted to avoid that as much as possible. Also because the process was not scalable enough, and we wanted to make it scalable. We set these KPIs, like the number amount of PRs has to be reduced, the number of misconfigurations has to be reduced, because a problem that we had before is that Jenkins was not powerful enough to run 50 pipelines at the same time. So it leads to misconfiguration in certain clusters because of whatever reason. We have some maintenance window where you can only push code or push configuration on 13 hours, and if the queue of Jenkins is full, your pipeline could be stuck because it's not on the maintenance window. So we had a lot of misconfigurations here and there, leading to operational time to resynchronize it manually. And imagine doing that on 100 of clusters. It was not ideal, let's say. So yeah, we wanted to improve all these metrics, absolutely.
You know, sitting down and establishing these metrics, creating a plan, a lot of things can look good on paper, but it's a different thing when it's put into practice. When putting these ideas into practice, did you change tools? Did you get rid of the infrastructure repo? What was that process like?
So what we did for sure, first, we got rid of Jenkins to deploy the configuration. We still use Jenkins in order to validate the configuration. They validate that everything is looking good and the diffs, and it will output the diff from the configuration that we want to apply from the configuration that is already applied on the cluster. So we already have Jenkins, but only for the CI part, let's say, like the integration part, but not the deployment part. So we get rid of Jenkins by creating a migration plan, and the migration plan was painful, but now it's working fine. So we are super happy about that. I mean, for sure, new clusters were created with Flux, but we had to migrate the old clusters to this Flux or this GitOps approach, And that was painful because in the end of the day, you don't want to cause any disruption, but it was pretty smooth. At the end of the day, everything was Helm and charts. So if you know the state of the Helm chart and the values being used, as I mentioned, everything was as code at that point in time, but the deployment mechanism was slightly different. It was pretty easy to synchronize instead of push model with pull model in Flex. It's always risky because you don't want to mess it up on production, you know. You don't want to impact the business. But it went that smooth, super smooth.
What are the advantages of the pull mechanism that you transitioned to? Did it end up unlocking any kinds of benefits?
Absolutely. And it's incredible the benefit that we unlock. So for example, one key benefit that we have now that we didn't before is the possibility to check what is going to be applied in an easy way. So before, as I mentioned, we had this mechanism of merging configuration in different repositories in a super ad hoc way. And it wasn't that easy to understand what is going to be applied. Okay, you open a PR with a few changes, but you are not 100% sure if this is what is going to be applied or something else because the pipeline didn't pass before. Just a stupid example. But now we have the certain of with a specific pull request, we have the specific div that is going to be applied because it runs this CI integration, checking what is going to be applied, comparing with the cluster. So this is one benefit that we have now that we didn't have before. And this was key to sell this migration to our managers, let's say. Something else that we gain was the confidence on the process, meaning that we could then rely on Jenkins to run all the pipelines to apply the configuration to the cluster. Instead, now all the clusters pulls the configuration from the Git repository, and it's much more faster, much more reliable, and whenever there is a synchronization issue, we get an alert. So we have this alerting in place now that we didn't have before. Also, we have a dedicated dashboard to showcase in a super simple way which is the container platform state in a super quick way with red indicating that something is missing and green is everything fine. So it's, yeah, really, really worthy. It was the effort of my way to this GitOps approach. I mean, in the end, standardizing and creating standard processes with upstream tooling make everything easier than using something super specific for your business. So having customized, having Flux, these tools that you have a lot of resources here and there, it's much easier than building your exporters, building everything, then expose the metrics somewhere, building the dashboards. That's a lot of effort for something that is already done. So this is something that we improve a lot by standardizing our way of working.
Okay.
A unified configuration also makes it easy to inspect the state of all clusters at once. This is great from a management perspective and a compliance point of view, which I assume Adidas probably cares about a lot. But did it also help with reliability?
Yeah, absolutely. So our managers and our stakeholders are happier than ever now because they know upfront what is going to be changed, and they are more confident with our teams than before. Before we had some fights, let's say, because we wanted to deploy something because of whatever reason, because of a component upgrade, system critical update or whatever. But you in our team, as you are not fully confident because you didn't rely on Jenkins and all the stuff, you cannot transmit this confidence to the different stakeholders, so they won't allow you to deploy these changes whenever you want. Now that we have full visibility on what is going to be changed, when is going to be changed, and what is going to be changed, and so on and so forth, we can go to the stakeholders and say, okay, this change is going to change this, this, and that on this way at this time, and it's going to affect only this region or whatever. So it's really easy to understand for the stakeholder what is going to be changed and what could be the impact on their business. So also something that we built around is this change log. And everything, as any other large company, everything has to be audited. Everything, every change has to be registered in some ticketing system. In our case, it's Jira, but it could be any other. So everything has to be correlated, and everything has to be linked to the project management setup. So we have this change log saying, okay, at this time, this day, this folk create this PR or merge this PR in main and was applying this this chain because it contains links to the PR with the divs. And so everything is now auditable, something that we lacked in the past, but now is possible. So again, this is only possible if you have the right tool in place with the standard processes, with the standard tooling. So yeah, for sure. Business, audit, security, they are more happier than ever with our current setup. Now they understand what is going to be changed, and we are 100% confident saying what is going to be changed.
Okay. Now, what you described up until now is a better deployment process that unlocks several benefits for the team. But as we say, you know, the devil is in the details. And we haven't talked about what happens in those clusters and how they are affected. Can you guide us through how you provision those clusters and how they're plugged into the GitOps process?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward, to be honest. Here, what we do is creating a managed cluster from GKS, whatever provider. We are using one, but it doesn't matter here. And we create this cluster from an API call. And then eventually what we do is pull some secrets, and in this case, Git repository secrets to access the Git repository, because in the end we have Bitbucket privately and so on and so forth. So we use private tokens to read the cluster configuration. So we inject these secrets in the cluster, bare cluster, and we install Flux, the usual commands, Flux install whatever. And we create two main objects, which are the Git repository, the customization, and eventually the cluster got in sync. And that's mainly it. It's true that we have room for improvements. For example, in order to have a cluster attached to the network, the Adidas network, we have to run some things manually yet. But we are working on that these days in order to solve this gap. It's something that still need to be standardized, as I mentioned. Having everything standard makes things much more easier. But we are working on that, and I'm confident to have that done in the upcoming weeks or months.
Okay.
And what about your multi-tenancy model? Can you talk about that and if it has changed, sure, you know, since you migrated?
Not really. I mean, we always had two different multi-tenancy models depending on the use case. So, for example, we have like power users, if that could be a name like this, where you get the full control of the unit, the cluster, the unit, this cluster. Like, for example, specific teams or expert teams like the monitoring team or the IBA team, probably they require cluster access if they want to install, I don't know, a new controller that requires the cluster admin permissions before pushing it to globally to the different clusters, so that they can request to have a full cluster for them. And then we have like the most common scenario, which are the developers of the different application at Adidas. They just get access to a new space for them. We create the role bindings, all the stuff to grant access to the specific namespace. And they just have access to different namespaces. If they don't have access at the cluster level, just at the namespace level. So that didn't change with the cluster configuration. At the end of the day, they don't care about cluster configuration at all. They just care about deploying their stuff. For sure, we have the power of influencing these teams to use GitOps, but they could deploy in any way. At the end, they are responsible for their deployments and their applications. So it's up to them to follow our guidelines or our recommendations, or just run and install from the laptops, and that's all.
It's been 2 years since the date that we started out with, you know, May 10th. What's the developer feedback been like, you know, after using the platform to deploy to production?
Yeah, so if we talk about developers, internal developers and us as a team, because at the end of the day, our users, our tenants, doesn't understand what we are doing with the cluster management. But if we are talking about us and also other platform teams, absolutely they are happy. And one sign that they are happy is that they want to be on board in our cluster management. So for example, as I think that this is like a common pattern in large companies. So we are continuing orchestration that we are part of platform engineering. And in platform engineering, we have different teams like the monitoring team, the API team, the security team, and they realize how good is our cluster management. So they want to be on board in our cluster management to deploy their stuff. So for example, if they want to roll out a new version of Prometheus per cluster, before they had a deployment strategy as any other developer in the company. So they could choose whatever they want. And they realize that our way of working is more flexible, also scalable, and so on and so forth, and reliable, which is key in this company. So that they are being on board in the GitOps repository, and they are using the same mechanisms as we are in container orchestration. So they are creating PRs, reviewing their changes, and follow the processes that we are following, because in the end, it makes sense, right? It makes a lot of sense to standardize all the processes and all the way of working in the different platforms.
At an organizational level, we often talk about, you know, getting, as you talked about previously, you know, all stakeholders aligned. Talk about the technical side and then, you know, the business. What about the business side throughout this whole story? Did they buy into the migration, and was it difficult to convince them to invest in it? What was that like?
Yeah, that was, I mean, it was clear that we had an issue. We had some outages here and there because of misconfiguration. So we had to change. That was clear. And we were evaluating different approaches. And you just think about scalability, as I mentioned. If you had to perform a change on 50 repositories at once, and also you had to review these 50 PRs with two people because we followed the 4 I's principle, if you count the number of hours to create the PRs and the review of the PRs, if you take like 15 minutes per person per PR, it's like 30 minutes per PR multiplied by 50. It's 24 hours or so, more or less. 24 hours to review one change. And 24 hours of people working is a lot of money. And then if you sell in this way to the manager saying, okay, I will reduce the cost from 24 hours of working to 30 minutes, it's a good selling point. But not only that, I mean, for sure the money is important and the effort is important, but also building processes more reliable in a way that everyone knows what is going to be applied and when it's going to be applied and what is going to be the diff, and everything could be auditable, and we gain traceability, everything around this process, this new process. It was easy to sell first because we had an issue. We caused some outages because of configuration not being applied correctly. And second, because we will optimize the process and we will gain more, or we will increase the reliability of the process, and also we get more visibility on what is going on in the container platform. Before was kind of a blind scenario where you push a button and you just hope that everything will work, but now it's easier to understand what is going on. And so yeah, they buy the solution pretty quickly.
Very good. Congratulations. And what would you do differently if you had to go back in time and do it all over again?
Yeah, as I mentioned, we lack or we miss some automations on the infrastructure level. We play around during this GitOps approach with Crossplane in order to automate this attachment to the network. But at that point in time, Crossplane was not that mature and was causing some issues in the etcd, in the control plane. And we hold this integration, this automation, until Crossplane was mature enough or was performing better, right? So that if I had to go back in time, I will find other solutions to attach the clusters to the network or to create other surrounding infrastructure around the Kubernetes cluster, because now we have to create some things manually that I don't want to do anymore, because in the end there are solutions out there, but we need to integrate these solutions into the current GitOps approach and the cluster management approach. It's possible. It's ongoing. As I mentioned before, it's ongoing. I know the team is working on that. But it's exhausting, or it's not exhausting at all, but it's really challenging, because you have to have everything in place before in order to create the Crossplane modules, and we have to deal with different departments and different teams in order to have everything ready to integrate with Crossplane. And this is something that takes time, and that's why I said that if I had to go back in time, or if I could go back in time, I will push a little bit more this initiative.
Now we're going to get to the very controversial part of the interview. We want to wrap up with a little bit more about, you, Ankel, as a person. You're currently working fully remotely, and you did so in your previous roles as well. Do you see yourself going back to the office in the future?
Never say never, okay? That's the first rule. But it's something that I don't think it's going to happen anymore. At least in tech roles where you can perform your role remotely, I don't see the benefit going every single day to the office. For sure, going to the office could bring some benefits. I'm not saying that not going to the office is the best option, but it has to be both beneficial for both the company and you, right? So if you are performing better in the office, but you lack some work-life balance, it's hard, right? But you have to find the balance. And it depends a lot. Also, it depends a lot on the company, because it's not the same. A large company that used to work in the office 100% of the time than a startup that born remotely and you don't have an office to go. And it's also different having hybrid models where you are pushed to go to the office. It's already a controversial topic, but I'll say that working remotely gives you the work-life balance that everyone deserves. That's true. But also, you have to provide the same or even more value to the company. If that is not happening, the company can push you to go to the office because of whatever reason. And this is what you had to find, right? And for sure, when you're applying to a position, you had to ask this kind of details. You had to ask if the people working in the company just to work remotely, or if they work remotely by default, or if they used to just go to the office to meet as a team and then they work remotely the rest of the year. So that's as a TLDR, let's say, going to the office has to make sense for both the company and you, and you as a professional. But going to the office just for the sake to be there is nonsense in 2024. Yeah, that I would say that.
Very good.
Strongly agree. What's next for you?
Yeah, what's next for me? So I'm still an individual contributor at Adidas. I mean, before joining Adidas, I played the role of engineering manager, tech lead in different positions. And I think that I miss a little bit this this part of growing people and managing different projects and so on and so forth. Yeah, I love tech for sure. That's why I don't pretend to leave the tech field at all. But I miss this engineering manager role in my life. So currently at Adidas, I'm an individual contributor. I'm the top level individual contributor. The next step will be a manager position. So yeah, that's my future. I'm not sure if it's going to be this year, the next year, or probably 2 years after this one. But yeah, eventually, I miss this role a little bit because I love to teach people. I love to grow people, follow up with people, and also to keep track of the projects and also design and implement different futures. But leveraging the team to build the product is something that I miss a lot.
Also understand that your team at a local level has grown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My local team has grown a little bit. I have a baby, 10 months old already. And yeah, I'm teaching him a little bit about the life. But it's amazing how fast they grow. I love him a lot. I cannot imagine my life without him anymore. It's amazing.
And I'm sure in no time he'll be learning GitOps and multi-tenancy and all the things we spoke about today.
Yeah. I already have these books for Sophie and the Kubernetes. It's like a comic or some pictures here and there. So this is going to be like the first books I will be reading to him. So
very good.
And if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do so?
So I say Twitter, probably, X, whatever, and that's the main channel I'm using these days. Also LinkedIn, but LinkedIn, as I said, is most for job seeking. And recently, I opened a Calendly. It's also in the header of my Twitter account, so you can schedule a 30-minute call. I love exchanging information, exchanging conversation with ex coworkers, with different folks from different companies, and understand how they are running their platforms. What are the challenges they are facing? I'm in touch with a few people from Docker, from Red Hat, ex coworkers, and I love to see that we are all kind of in the same position with Kubernetes as core, but then we have to build something on top, and there is nothing generic enough to be installed on top of Kubernetes. So yeah, I'm always interested on talking with different people with different backgrounds, and yes, always open to listen and to share.
All right, Ankel. Well, thank you very much for your time. I'm sure our listeners will enjoy hearing about your experience. And as you mentioned, it's very easy to get in touch with you. I didn't have any difficulties, so I imagine other people will have a similar experience. Best of luck with everything in the future, and we'll be in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure.
All right. Take care.